And good afternoon to you on this Monday, the day after Easter. Thrilled to be back in this chair, filling in for my friend Paul W. Smith on the Focus Show on JR. We've got a busy couple of hours planned for you, some outstanding guests, a lot to get to, and it is another newsworthy day, to be sure. I covered sports early in my career, of course, news later on. We get a little bit of both today as producer extraordinaire Mike Parsons joins me now, beginning with, Mike, NCAA basketball championship game in Indianapolis tonight, and the University of Michigan has a chance again to win a national championship.
Yeah, right in the heart of Big Ten country. And it'll be interesting to see the condition that Yaxel Lennenborg is in. You know, he's been their rock all season. It was an ankle and a knee injury that he sustained on Saturday, right?
Right, but was able to return. And he said after the game that he will be there on Monday night. So we will see. Clearly, this is a very, very talented team. But he is an engine, certainly, that helps make the Wolverines go, and they have romped through this tournament, defeating opponents by wide margins, five times, over 90 points scored in this NCAA tournament season for Michigan. And they'll face a UConn team that knows all about NCAA championships, though, with a couple in the last 3 years, including back-to-back national championships. So the matchup should be outstanding tonight.
Yeah, and you know, I grew up in a Michigan State household, and obviously I'm always rooting for the Spartans and Tom Izzo when they're in it. But this Michigan team is a heck of a lot of fun to watch. I mean, they're not just shooting threes and playing hero ball. I mean, they're a quick team. They're fast breaking down the court. And I mean, what they did to Arizona, even the coach was like, wow, no one's ever done that. No one's done that to us this season. And It was almost like Michigan was in another echelon. They were playing at another gear,
right? And so it'll be very interesting as a result to see what happens in terms of championship pedigree against this Michigan team that, you know, was put together with players out of the portal and NIL, and you know, but they've come together in a cohesive unit, and it is one talented team. That's a game, by the way, that you'll be able to hear tonight on WJR. Tip is 8:50 p.m. from Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. And
I'm going to be drinking my coffee a little later this afternoon.
To stay awake for that one, right?
Yeah.
With the 8:50 p.m. tip time. Coming up a little bit later in the show today, in fact, we'll talk with Dave Bichnow, who is CEO of the Detroit Local Organizing Committee, because Detroit, after tonight, is on the clock. The city of Detroit at Ford Field will host the Final Four in 2027, the latest of the big events that the city of Detroit, through the Detroit Sports Commission, Visit Detroit, and other stakeholders have attracted to our city. And that will be huge for us again a year from now to be able to be host of the Final Four.
Yeah, and it was an absolute blast in 2009, and the city of Detroit has just gotten better at holding these big events. I mean, I think everyone was blown away who came here for the draft a couple of years ago, and I can only imagine that momentum continuing with the Final Four. You know, even if we do get, a cold April weekend, but hopefully we have a nice one next year. But it's going to be an absolute blast either way.
Looking forward to it very much. A lot of other things in the news today. Waiting on a 1 o'clock President Trump press conference today. I'm sure he's going to talk about the rescue of the second airman shot down over Iran. But also there's talk of a potential ceasefire in this conflict with Iran. That's something we're watching and paying very close attention to this afternoon as well.
Yeah, and another deadline, too, for them to reopen the Straits of Hormuz, or else, well, He said he was going to do many things to Iran if they didn't do it. None of them pleasant.
Yeah, and we'll see how that unfolds as well. We'll get into that a little bit more later this hour. But again, scheduled that 1 o'clock press conference from the White House with President Trump. Other things on your radar today, Mike?
Well, about the time President Trump is scheduled to speak, the Artemis II is supposed to be approaching the moon, doing their lunar flyby. And I think about 1:45, right as we're welcoming Ryan into the show, Artemis will officially surpass one of the Apollo missions as being the furthest that man has flown into space, miles wise. Yeah. So that'll be cool. And I think they're going to be outside of mission control communications for 45 minutes. And that's got to be very unsettling for both the people up in space and on the ground.
I would think so for sure. And space travel to me is still an amazing thing. I mean, I'm old enough where, you know, the initial descent to the moon and the first steps on the moon and, those rockets taken off, and I just...
Well, and you know what?
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, watching these space shuttle launches, it never gets old.
No.
Even though we've been doing them since the 60s. I remember watching last week, and you had excited butterflies in your stomach because, A, you know, you're hoping there's no disaster, and B, I mean, the fact that we can hurl human beings into space with mechanics and engineering, it's almost like a miracle of science.
Really is, and just fascinating to watch. And I know there are some who think that spending money on space travel is a waste. I'm not in that camp. I think it's fantastic. We've been explorers. I think we need to continue to be explorers, and I think what we learn is incredible, and my eyes are glued when for launches and for the coverage of these incredible events.
Yeah, I mean, look, if it wasn't for space exploration, we wouldn't have satellites and the internet and the so yeah, there is some tangible benefit to it other than just it's kind of cool.
So something else that is cool is an opportunity for Wolverine fans to win a Michigan basketball limited edition basketball courtesy of Nyko Sports. Be caller 9 right now, 1-800-859-0WJR. That's 1-800-859-0957 to win the Michigan basketball limited edition basketball courtesy of Nyko Sports, one of only 2,026 being produced. This season for Michigan basketball, certainly one for the history books. To help celebrate this amazing season, this limited edition, fully licensed basketball is now available. The ball recaps the entire season with scores and opponents and logos. All the official rules at WJR.com. Again, caller 9 at 1-800-859-0WJR. You can also purchase yours. Visit Nyko Sports, that's NIKCO Sports.com. We're back with more on Focus on WJR after these messages. Very happy to be here today with you, sitting in for Paul W. Smith on Focus on WJR. Again, we are awaiting a scheduled 1 p.m. press conference today with President Trump. We will carry that when it happens. We expect that he will address the rescue of the second airman from deep inside Iran that occurred over the weekend, as well as touch on the immediate ceasefire that's being negotiated with the help of the Pakistanis. And we'll see. President Trump has issued one of his deadlines for this to happen. If not, he's got plans that he expects to implement if Iran doesn't see it his way. Let's get a little bit more on this as we welcome in retired Lieutenant Colonel Rocky Rochkowski joining us on WJR. Rocky, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon, Dave. Long time no talk.
But, yeah,
But glad to hear you on WJR.
Great to do it here today. Big picture, and I guess let's begin though with the incredible rescue of the second airman shot down over Iran. The first U.S. airman was rescued quickly after the plane was shot down. The second took some time. Happened over the weekend. Incredibly difficult, to extract him out. Your thoughts on the complexity and certainly the fact that this happened successfully, this mission.
Sure.
What an incredible thing.
Yeah, Dave, listen, this is something called a CSAR. A SAR, S-A-R, is a search and rescue mission. A C in front of that means it's a combat search and rescue. So not only are you searching and trying to rescue this pilot, but you're doing it in combat operations, behind hostile lines. So now we're talking about operating inside of Iran. So these are boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. And how the CSAR occurred, I need to take a step back and kind of explain that every one of us, be it a ground troops or aircraft pilots, when you go into combat, because about only 10% of the entire military actually sees combat or goes into combat. The rest are predominantly support services, and they'll be involved in combat, mm-hmm. but their support services usually behind some type of line. Here, the line is the border of Iran. And these pilots and individuals that are going behind these lines have what's called a Blue Force tracker. And I had one. It's a small kind of like a pager device. My team had one when we operated. And this tracker is like a ping device, an mm-hmm. identifier that satellites can pick up on. Plus, each one of these pilots does have a hand, a weapon, and also a communications radio that they can communicate up to 200, maybe 300 miles away and get satellite communications to try to get search and rescue abilities. And they also have what's called a blood sheet, a sheet that they can give to the enemy or to people inside the enemy territory that could potentially help them and return them back to positive forces. But each one of these pilots, as well as individuals that go into combat areas or remote areas or special operations forces, go through what's called SEER training, S-E-R-E. And that's for survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. And they learn these types of tactics. And that's exactly what this colonel, this mm-hmm. Air Force colonel did, was he basically evaded the enemy and escaped and resisted and knew that to launch his little beacon, he needed to get to the higher ground. And he basically scaled about using a small compass and his tactics and what he's learned. He scaled up a mountain range of about 7,000 feet to launch his beacon and communicate. And now we've learned also through the president, who the president's going to talk about this at 1 o'clock. And it's also been disclosed that we had Reaper drones flying overhead, giving them air cover. So when the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard of Iran, were getting closer within a couple of miles, or as we call it, clicks, which are kilometers, a couple of clicks or maybe a little bit further, if they were approaching his general area, they would shoot him up or fire him up. And now we've seen videos of a lot of injured and dead IRGC soldiers in that area where this pilot was recovered. But the key was, the real key here, is the implementation and the use of the CIA with the military. And that's branched by a group called the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, working with our CIA to basically send out deception tactics. Mm-hmm. And these deception tactics were internet related, as well as communication saying, hey, the U.S. already got him, and they got him to the east of your location, and that's where you need to be looking. And it would be in Farsi or in a Persian language that they would understand. And then also flying these missions further east and making the IRGC believe, wait a minute, if the Americans are looking over here, he must be in this area. So we were playing deception tactics and all at the same time still watching over this pilot with these Reaper drones.
Well, and it was a race against time, frankly, because the Iranians, wanted to get to him first. I mean, you'd be looking at potential hostage situation and leverage, as this conflict continues. this had to be done and done fast.
Absolutely. And it's a high-risk extraction. And we've now learned also that we lost a couple MC-130s. What an MC-130, usually people have heard of C-130s. They're right. Used for parachute or cargo. MC, the M stands for mission, C stands for cargo. Each one of the Air Force aircraft or Navy aircraft have a letter in front of it, and it stands for something. Like the A-10 was used for attack. The A-10 was drawing fire from the IRGC, and that's what got hit. The one of the A-10s was hit, but was able to have a controlled crash in a friendly country. But the MC-130s are special operations aircraft. These are C-130 Hercules aircraft that the United States Air Force uses for special operation command purposes. They're used for infiltration, extracting special operation forces, low-level flying at night. I mean, these guys fly super low, and they train maybe even, you know, a couple hundred feet or even less above the tree level. Aerial refueling of helicopters, because they can fly so slow, they can actually refuel aircraft, helicopters in flight. And they also drop troops, vehicles, supplies, and they support combat search and rescue. And two of our MC-130s were actually lost because they got stuck in the sand. They couldn't fly them out. So basically, they had to destroy them and destroy all the technology and classified information that's on there.
Right. You don't want that to get into enemy hands. And briefly, in the minute that we have left here, a ceasefire hopefully is possible in this conflict as well. I know President Trump is going to touch on that as well in his scheduled 1 p.m. press conference. But Rocky, thank you for the insight here on this rescue of the second airman shot down over Iran. It is an incredibly successful mission, thankfully, and much more to come in this story as well from the president coming up at 1 o'clock. Great to talk with you, Rocky. Thank you so much.
Great to talk to you again, Dave. Let's pray for peace. God bless you. Take care.
Thank you. Rocky Rutschkowski, the retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, joining us on Focus on WJR, Dave Llewellyn, sitting in for Paul W. Smith today. Happy to have you along. We're back with more after this. Happy Monday to you all. Pleased to be back in this seat, filling in for Paul W. Smith on Focus on WJR. Want to talk now with a friend, David Carlton. He is the principal in Stuart Pittman Incorporated, located in downtown Detroit. He has gotten himself involved in quite a project. You cross the MacArthur Bridge on your way to Belle Isle. The first thing you see, really, is this white structure. It was built in the early 1900s. The Detroit Boat Club, or the Belle Isle Boathouse, however you want to describe it, it is a historic, iconic structure in the city of Detroit. It has been vacant since 2022, I believe. It has fallen into disarray. It is going to take a lot of effort to rehabilitate and redevelop this historic structure. And David Carlton thinks he's the man to get this done. David, welcome. It's great to see you again. And you've had some challenges in your career from a development and rehab standpoint. The GAR building, the castle that so many of us know, the iconic castle, that was part of your work. You're taking on another incredible building with Detroit history in the case of the Boathouse on Belle Isle.
Taking it on and really excited, really proud. There's rare opportunities like this nationally in any city. Detroit's offered me a few of those. The GAR building, which you remember, was certainly one. And in comparison, the Boathouse, which has been vacant but watched for the past 6-7 years, the GAR, if you remember, was vacant for 30 years.
Yeah.
The roof was in. It was just a mess. It was basically a large pigeon coop. So the first time I walked into the Boathouse, I was blown away. It's probably a 7 out of 10 in terms of the interior condition and what we have to work with there. Everyone drives by, you know, the roof is bad, the plaster's falling off on the outside, whatever that's called. Inside is a totally different story.
Well, and I've been inside the boathouse. It's been years now, but you know, they used to bring some of the hydroplane drivers there. We had press conferences there inside on the first floor. Yeah. You know, the woodwork and the ceilings and the, you know, the flooring inside. I mean, it is an incredible structure that it would be a shame if it can't be, you know, saved and preserved and rehabilitated.
Whenever I hear the words historic building and demolition, it kind of gets my attention. Yeah. And certainly that's how we fell into some of these previous projects. But this was something almost 2 years ago, the DNR said, we don't do this. Mm-hmm. And they put it out for public comment, which I commented on, and then didn't sit down quickly enough because suddenly I was there with an LOI, an RFP, and we spent better part of the last year negotiating a lease, 50 years, with plans to open in 2029.
All right, so how do we get there? You know, the DNR had said take $2 million to demo the boathouse. Sure. It might take $30 or $40 million to to kind of put it back together. So what's the plan?
So it would have taken a bit more than $2 million to tear it down, but that's another story. Fortunately, we're not facing that. You know, this is really a community-supported project. There's so much interest in this city of Detroit, not only in historic architecture and preservation. The riverfront now is on fire, and it's being recognized internationally as a hotspot. You know, every other week some magazine says Detroit's the go-to, et cetera, et cetera. Certainly with what Dan Gilbert and his team are going to do along the Rensen, Matt Cullen, and now Sandy Pierce just making the whole riverfront. It's going to take, I won't say Herculean effort, but it's going to take a little bit of everyone pitching in, individual donors, the foundations we're speaking to, historic tax credits. We're working with this phenomenal guy, Gordon Goldie at Plant Moran, to make sure that we're capitalizing on all the historic tax credits that we'll gather at the tail end. And then you get into traditional financing, investors for a couple of phenomenal restaurants we're going to bring online. It's really an exciting, even this part is exciting, is how do we get there? You know, we've done renovation. Chrisman Construction will knock it out of the park. It's how do we get to that point?
Right, right. And, you know, this building, early 1900s, right? And
1902.
It was originally built to support the rowing team and rowing efforts on the Detroit River.
Yeah.
And at one time, there were 70 boathouses along the Detroit River?
Absolutely. The history of rowing and sailing in the city of Detroit on the riverfront, it goes back even further than, you know, civilization, if you will.
Right.
1902, it was put together. And the big push, really, with the city and the state with my negotiations, I no longer call it the Boat Club because that's exclusive. This is the Detroit Boathouse on Belle Isle, which means when we're done, this is a community asset. There are two programs there, the Detroit Community Sailing Center and the Friends of Detroit Rowing, which do just incredible work. And I'm not a boater, so I had no idea. I walked in, said, yeah, let's save this building. And I was like, well, what are those dozens of people doing over there in the corner?
Yeah.
So I've really learned about those programs. And if we can build a foundation for them to grow, reach out to more youth and adults here in the city, really the whole region, you know, it's win-win.
And so that was the original purpose of the building, but it became much more than that. It became a social club as well. I read 900 members at one time in its heyday, but you know, it hasn't been maintained. It hasn't. Things go through chapters and cycles, right? And now you need a new chapter for this incredible building.
And again, I feel incredibly blessed to have this opportunity. You know, again, it's a one. I thought the castle was once in a lifetime. You know, that Civil War era, beautiful castle, stone, blah blah blah. To fall into this and have another opportunity. You know, my parents, man, they were history buffs.
Yep.
And they instilled the love of this city in all the kids. So, you know, to be able to carry that on and leave a mark, you know, it's a blessing, truly.
So you don't see it from the outside necessarily right now, but there is work already beginning on this project. You're doing some interior digital imaging. What will that allow you to do?
You know, what I love about this, back in the day on other projects, you know, an architect would walk through with a clipboard and a measuring tape. This team that I'm working with out of Madison, Wisconsin, Insight Consulting Architects, somehow specializes in historic boathouses, which to me initially is like crazy. But they went through, two men, probably 48 hours over the course of a week with scanners, literally digitally measuring, taking photographs of the entire site. They'll go back now to their offices. They'll build all the models. So as we move forward in figuring out what's where and who's what and where, what's going to look like at the end of the day, you know, it's already in their computer. They've loaded it up. It's exciting. That part's exciting to watch as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you're going to have a lot of other activity on the inside and the outside of the building as this progress, as this project progresses. If people want to keep track of the progress, what's the best way for them to do that?
You know, so we're going to launch our new website this month, and that's going to obviously track everything. And then social media is all over the place. We're going to have much more of a presence. We just signed our lease at tail end of January.
Right.
So it's been talking about it for 2 years, but now it's getting fun and exciting, and there'll definitely be a presence.
Looking forward to watching your progress. David, thank you so much. David Carlton, he is the principal with Stuart Pittman, joining us on the WJR Focus Show. Dave Llewellyn sitting in for Paul W. Smith. The Detroit Boathouse, the new chapter, it's coming on the Detroit Riverfront. We're back with more after this. Happy to be joining you on this Monday, sitting in for Paul W. Smith on Focus on WJR. Again, we're awaiting a 1 o'clock scheduled press conference, news conference with President Trump, who is expected to update us on the situation in Iran with the rescued airmen and also the ceasefire that's been discussed and his deadline for implementing that ceasefire. That's to come, scheduled again at 1 o'clock. We'll carry that live when it happens. In the meantime, we're joined by Matt Friedman, co-founder of Tanner Friedman Strategic Communications. He covers, in addition to his day job, comments on all things media as a former member of the media and also a media watcher. And we wanted to welcome Matt today to talk about the return to the Today Show of anchor Savannah Guthrie after just the incredible human tragedy, family tragedy that she's endured with her mother, who was abducted from her home in Arizona. Matt Friedman, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Dave. Great to hear you on any media platform, but especially this one.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a thrill to be here to fill in for my friend Paul W. On this Monday. This case, the return of Savannah Guthrie to the Today Show on NBC Today. She's been off for a couple of months. I mean, her mother went missing in February, and what a gut wrenching time, tragic time for the family. But at some point, I suppose you have to try to get back to life as you knew it once before, and that includes, in her case, work, as is the case for so many of us. But what a sad and tragic story this has been.
Sure is. And I think one of the things that's important to remember about this is the case got so much attention, not only because of the movie-like qualities that a lot of the case had, but also because of Savannah Guthrie's role in our media system. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is the reason why the Today Show is still relevant, is still successful, is still such a big moneymaker for NBC is because of the personality nature of the show. That's why its audience is loyal, is that viewers feel like they're inviting these personalities into their homes. They're sort of a part of the family. At the same time, the viewers feel like they're a part of the family of the host of the show, mm-hmm. because that's always been part of the brand of the Today Show. So Savannah Guthrie is somebody who viewers of that show felt like they knew. And when this tragedy happened to her and this mystery happened to her, you know, all the other networks covered it as a news story because of the celebrity aspect, because of the qualities of the story that it had. But this audience has been waiting for her to come back. So it was a real TV moment like we don't see very often anymore, her return to the show today. And I think viewers saw a lot of emotion, but they also saw a professional at work who was able to do her job.
Right. And she had been back as far as sitting for an interview, last month, about the case and all of that. So maybe that kind of eased the transition back. But you know, in a family like that, the Today Show family, and it really becomes that. She had to be incredible. It had to be comforting to her, I would think, to be back with those group of individuals who clearly care for her and for her well-being.
Yeah, I think you saw that on TV today. And if you look at the clips, you can't fake that. I mean, Dave, I think you can attest to this better than anybody. I can as a producer, where we always wanted our anchors on set to have chemistry, to get along to the point where the viewers would know that these people like and trust and respect each other. And it was very clear today that they have that on the Today Show. That just permeates through the screen. The other thing the Today Show has that almost nobody has in media anymore is they have fans who travel to New York and wake up before dawn to go outside and be a part of the show. And it sure looked to me like Savannah Guthrie was comforted by those fans surrounding her on this day.
And as great as all of that is, she's still living with the fact that her mother is missing, that she has not been found, that there are so many unanswered questions still out there. It's just, any way you look at it, it's just, a tragedy.
It is, and it's really hard to get attention for unsolved cases. I think a lot of your colleagues at WJR who've worked in and around news can attest to this, that the longer it goes on without being unsolved, the harder it is to make it into news. So at some point, she's going to have to get up and do this again, I presume tomorrow and again, because it's her job. And as I said, she's a professional. But the case remains unsolved, and all of NBC's competitors are kind of off of it now. Nobody's anchoring their newscasts from outside the home in Tucson, Arizona anymore. But she and her colleagues know the case is that maybe there's a killer out there or a kidnapper out there. All of those unknowns are on top of mind for that news staff and trying to do their show every day.
I think a lot of people, they may look at this too. And because of all of that attention, because of her celebrity, if you will, being part of the Today Show and coming into people's homes every day, like how has more progress not been made in this case? How has this gone on for over 2 months with seemingly no answers, with no suspect, how?
Yeah, especially in this day and age with Ring doorbells, with cell phone video, with cameras everywhere tracking us. It sure is a mystery, and it begs all of those questions and more. And it'll be interesting for me to see in the media analyst role that I have, but also from the PR role, as I've done media training and some other things for law enforcement, is to try to see where this goes. Is this such an anomaly, or can something be learned from this case to help in other ways?
Well, and it's, you have observed things, I don't know how closely you watched it, but if you had to grade, if you will, the performance of the spokespeople out there, the sheriff, the police officials, what have you sensed over these couple of months when they have spoken about this case and either the information they presented or didn't present as it related to Savannah Guthrie's mother?
There's a couple of things I think they did well. Number one is their obligation of law enforcement in the early moments or hours of something like this is to reassure the community if the community is indeed safe, if there are no risks or no reason for fear for anybody else in the community. They seem to do that. The other thing they seem to do well is to use public communication platforms to try to advance their case. So they did that with some videos of the family and otherwise that they released. So I think just in terms of pure fundamentals from a PR standpoint, they did a good job. However, so many questions unanswered, so many unknowns, so little progress seemingly made, it's hard to call this a success because we hear time and time again how helpful the public is to law enforcement to crack and solve cases, and that hasn't happened here despite all of the attention. So it begs the question, you know, did law enforcement push all the right buttons with the public that they needed to?
Well, and also, you know, the resources available, you know, locally from a state standpoint, federally as well, for such a high profile case like this. And it's just the fact that there's been so little progress toward answers is, I mean, as I look at it, it's like, this just adds to the heartbreaking aspect of this for the family, most importantly.
It has to. And it's counter to some of the adages that we know is typically the more attention a case gets at the beginning, the more helpful it is to the investigation. This case got an extraordinary amount of attention for all the reasons we talked about, celebrity and just unique angles to this that made it seem like it was something out of a movie. And it didn't seem to help much. And I don't know what that means.
Yeah, yeah. Appreciate, as always, your insight, Matt Friedman, co-founder of Tanner Friedman Strategic Communications. You see him regularly on media across Detroit, and we're thrilled to have him on the Paul W. Smith Show today, talking about the return of Savannah Guthrie, the anchor of the Today Show, to that broadcast following this 2 month or so period where she was off the air as a result of this family tragedy involving her mother. As always, thank you, Matt.
Anytime, Dave. Great to talk to you.
Talk with you again soon. Matt Friedman joining us as we wrap up hour one of Focus on WJR. Dave Llewellyn sitting in for Paul W. Smith. Again, we're awaiting a press conference addressed by President Trump, updates on the situation in Iran, and the possible ceasefire and the deadline that he has imposed for that to take place. All of that and more as we continue on JR after the news and these messages. Happy to be in this chair today, filling in for Paul on Focus on WJR. Again, we're awaiting the press conference, the comments of President Trump following the Iran rescue mission of the second U.S. airman who was shot down over Iran. We expect that momentarily, and we will go to it live just as soon as it happens from the White House. In the meantime, we want to bring in Marie Osborne, WJR's Director of Community Affairs and News. Over the weekend, the severe storms that many of us encountered included an EF1 tornado confirmed in Van Buren Township. Marie, good afternoon to you. A lot of rain in my house.
It was a lot of rain at our house, too.
Yeah.
Little flood going on there, too. And it was interesting, too. We never saw the really dark skies, even though we were under a tornado warning and the sirens were fired up. So it was a weird storm all the way together. So any way you look at it, the National Weather Service said that this EF1 touched down in Van Buren Township and the Belleville area with winds strong enough to tear off roofs. They toppled some trees, damaged some vehicles. Crews say the tornado formed as an intense thunderstorm pushed through the region, and then it was spotted near Belleville just before 6 o'clock. Despite the damage, no reported injuries, so that's good news. Farther south, damage in parts of Monroe County, that included Whiteford Township, Lambertville. It was caused by powerful straight-line winds in this case, not a tornado. Mm-hmm. Those winds can top 60 miles per hour. They can knock out power. Utilities say about 14,000 customers lost their electricity during the storms. Everybody back online by Sunday night. Now, Governor Whitmer has asked the federal government for disaster aid following a separate deadly tornado outbreak that happened last month in southwest Michigan. You'll remember this one. This was the deadliest weather event in the state in nearly 50 years. And what happened there was that this storm came on so quickly that the National Weather Service had trouble getting out its warnings, Dave, as you know, on that one. So, and it did cause some deaths and an awful lot of damage.
Yeah, an active storm season so far this spring in Michigan, to be sure. And as you say, in this case, the most recent case on Saturday, fortunately, no injuries there. And that's always the best news, of course.
Right, right. So, you know, it's the weather is definitely, we're in this time of year, we're in tornado season. It's always good to know your plan, what to do, especially if you have kids and pets. What is the plan for the family? Where are you going to meet? Where's your safe space in the house? It's always good to know those things during this season. And just go over it with your friends, you know, or your family to make sure everybody's on board.
And in this case, you're right, there were sirens. We heard them at our house. And the warnings that, now we get them on our phones and everything. And it's always best to heed those warnings to try to keep yourselves and your families certainly safe in these weather events.
Right, exactly. And I know, Dave, we are standing by. I know you are as well for this press conference with the president. Looks like it's scheduled to start at 1 o'clock, right. But he's yet to hit the podium. Sometimes these things take time.
They do. We'll continue to watch that. In the meantime, you mentioned Governor Whitmer and the request for federal aid for storm damage. She has also declared now an emergency, an energy emergency in the state of Michigan. Some relaxation of certain standards of gasoline and production, with the change of seasons from blends, in order to provide hopefully some relief for drivers as gas prices continue to go up. I mean, I even passed on my way here, a $4 price point for gas now. That remains an issue as the Iran conflict continues.
Right, and the Strait of Hormuz, as we know, that is the bottleneck where a lot of this fuel comes from. Now, we don't get a lot of our fuel through the Middle East, but this is just causing global panic and global price problems. I know that last week when I filled up my car, and I don't drive a semi, but I do have to use premium gas. Yeah. It was $86.
Yeah.
And that hurt. And I just in fact, my husband was the one filling up the tank, and I said, it's a car. It's not even an SUV.
Right.
So yeah, it's an eye popper.
All right, Marie, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. President Trump is at the podium in the White House. We want to go there now live.
Exactitude. And we're here today to celebrate the success of one of the largest, most complex, most harrowing combat searches. I guess you would call it a search and rescue mission ever attempted by the military. Generally, when planes are knocked down in war, especially when you're fighting a strong group, an evil group, you can't really do this because you send in 200 men to pick up one. And it's something that's usually not attempted as much as you want to attempt. And bad things happen to that one or two. And in this case, we did two, and might not have been attempted before, but we did. And we had great talent, but we got a little luck, too, I would say. And we were helped by a lot of people, a lot of great people. And it was an honor to be involved with it. It's very historic. This is a rescue that's very historic. It'll go down in the books. Late Thursday night, an American F-15 fighter jet went down deep inside enemy territory in Iran while participating in Operation Epic Fury, where we're doing unbelievably well, well at a level that nobody's ever seen before. The entire country can be taken out in one night, and that night might be tomorrow night. Both members of the crew ejected from the aircraft and landed alive on Iranian soil. I immediately was asked to make a decision. I ordered the U.S. Armed Forces to do whatever was necessary to bring our brave warriors back home, a risky decision, because we could have ended up with 100 dead as opposed to one or two. It's a hard decision to make. But in the United States military, we leave no American behind. We don't do it. Within hours, our armed forces deployed 21 military aircraft into hostile airspace, many flying at very low altitude, being shot by bullets. You bring rifles into play when you're going that low, but there are also certain advantages. And in broad daylight over Iran for 7 hours at times facing very, very heavy enemy fire. We have a helicopter that's got a lot of bullets in it. It's amazing. We just realized how good those weapons are. Our machines are. Nobody has the equipment that we have, and nobody has the military that we have, not even close. We're the most powerful military anywhere in the world by far. The flight crews and warfighters aboard those aircraft took extraordinary risks to rescue their fellow service members. This first wave of search and rescue forces successfully located the pilot of the F-15, and he was extracted from enemy territory by an HH-60 Jolly Green 2 helicopter. Fabulous machine as our warriors faced gunfire at very close range. It's amazing that when you look at the machinery, what happened, that nobody was even injured. Meanwhile, the second crew member, a weapons system officer, highly respected colonel, had landed a significant distance away from the pilot. When you're going at those speeds, even if you go out 2 or 3 seconds later, it's miles. It's miles and miles away because you're going fast. He was injured quite badly and stranded in an area teeming with terrorists from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps RUF group, as well as besieged militia and local authorities. On top of everything else, they told the communities actually inside of Iran, the people of Iran, they were given a tremendous incentive to find this pilot. Despite the peril, the officer followed his training and climbed into the treacherous mountain terrain and started climbing toward a higher altitude, something they were trained to do in order to evade capture. They want to always go as far away from the site of the shootdown. You want to go as far away because they all head right to that site. You want to be as far away as you can. And he was injured, and he was an amazing, amazing thing. He scaled cliff faces, bleeding rather profusely, treated his own wounds, and contacted American forces to transmit his location. They have a very sophisticated beeper-type apparatus that is on them at all times. And when they go out on these missions, they make sure they have lots of battery space, and they're in good shape. And this one worked really well, amazingly, saved his life. We immediately mobilized a massive operation to retrieve him from the mountain holdout. And he kept going higher and higher. The mountain kept getting rougher and rougher and really very, very hard to find. The second rescue mission involved 155 aircraft, including 4 bombers, 64 fighters, 48 refueling tankers, 13 rescue aircraft, and more. We were bringing them all over, and a lot of it was subterfuge. We wanted to have them think he was in a different location because they had a vast military force out there. Thousands of people were looking. So we wanted them to look in different areas, so we were scattered all over like we were right on top of them. We had 7 different locations where they thought, and they were very confused. They said, well, wait a minute, they've got groups here, they've got groups there. It's an amazing thing. I was listening to these great people, these great generals, General Raisin Kane, who's amazing, and Pete Hegseth was amazing. But I listened to the whole thing. It was pretty amazing. So they had all these different sites where everybody thought he was located. We think we have him over there because they have 9 planes circling a little area that's 25 miles down the coast. So in a breathtaking show of skill and precision, lethality and force, America's military descended on the area, the real area, engaged the enemy, rescued the stranded officer, destroyed all threats, and exited Iranian territory while taking no casualties of any kind. The heroic F-15 weapons system officer had evaded capture on the ground in Iran for almost 48 hours. That's a long time when you're in tough shape and when you're bleeding. It's a long time. When we left, as you probably know, We had two large planes, pretty old planes. It carried a lot. We needed a lot more equipment going in than coming out, obviously, because going in, we needed to be able to scale mountains. And we had a lot of equipment. But the sand was, it was sandy, wet sand. So we thought there may be a problem taking off because of the weight of the plane. And then we also had all the men jumping back onto the planes. And they got pretty well bogged down. And we had a contingency plan, which was unbelievable, where lighter, faster aircraft came in and they took them out. We blew up the old planes. And we blew them up to smithereens because we had equipment on the planes that, frankly, we'd like to take, but I don't think it was worthwhile spending another 4 hours there taking it off. So we didn't want anybody to have, we have the best equipment anywhere in the world. We didn't want anybody examining our anti-aircraft and other equipment. So these were large planes that were old and pretty old, and we blew them up. And we had faster, lighter planes come in, and they were able to land on the sand. We needed the bigger planes because we had so much equipment that we needed. We took three helicopters over there, which were very strongly used and couldn't have lived without them. They did, and they performed unbelievably well. And if you'd see it, you wouldn't believe it. They came off the plane, and these guys had them, the rotors were off. They rebuilt these helicopters in less than 10 minutes. And that was one of the more amazing things. These are helicopters, small, unbelievably powerful, but small, very small, so it can get into certain areas. And they got them off the plane, and they rebuilt all three of them in a matter of less than 10 minutes. It's pretty amazing what the genius of these people. Who would think that? You'd think it would take 5 days to build them. And in some companies, it would take 5 days, and they wouldn't do it well. But they served us well. As Commander-in-Chief, I never forget the extraordinary risk taken by the warriors that we send into battle. And the genius, I mean, think of it, having a contingency of three planes waiting because we think the sand is so bad that we probably won't be able to take off. And the planes really got bogged. The sand was, this was not much of a runway. This was a farm, not a runway. It's a farm, but it did the trick. But to have a contingency as opposed to having to wait 2 days, can you imagine right in the middle? This was central. This was right, you would call it central casting if you were doing a movie for location. And probably the toughest area of Iran where we'd be sitting there. So these planes came in, those pilots came in so fast and so quick and got out of there. Everybody got aboard and just got 15-minute intervals. One load out, one load out, one load out. The three, it happened, and we were watching, and we said, that's amazing. It's, in many ways, I was almost more impressed by the contingency that we had than the fact that, you know, if we would have had a runway or decent soil, but it was an amazing thing. But we thank God for every single one of them. And the talent, the genius is not even talent, it's genius. It's the whole ball game, every one of them. If you look at what we did with Maduro, we went into a military compound, a massive, with thousands and thousands of soldiers, and within a matter of minutes, and he lived behind iron doors. There were steel doors, broke them down so quickly, and within almost minutes, he was in the back of these planes. It was a similar group. Incredible. We have incredibly talented people. And if the time comes, we move heaven and earth to bring them home safely. We're going to bring our people home safely. I want to thank every member of the U.S. Armed Forces involved in these historic operations. They really were historic. It's just not something that's done. And you'd understand it. Not that they don't want to do it, but when you're going into areas, when you look at these helicopters, when you look at the amount of bullets and everything else that they took, when you go into these areas, you don't come out like we came out. God was watching us, I tell you. Well, it was the Easter. We were in the Easter territory, I guess. But God was watching us. Amazing. Because when you look at the machinery, they took damage. It tells you, first thing I said is, these are unbelievable machines, how they flew back and not even much of a problem. But these two extraordinary rescues, because it was two, and as you probably know, we didn't talk about the first one for an hour, and then somebody leaked something, which we'll hopefully find that leaker. We're looking very hard to find that leaker, and talked about there's somebody missing. They basically said that we have one and there's somebody missing. Well, they didn't know there was somebody missing until this leaker gave the information. So whoever it was, we think we'll be able to find it out because we're going to go to the media company that released it, and we're going to say, national security, give it up or go to jail. And we know who, and you know who we're talking about, because some things you can't do. Because when they did that, all of a sudden, the entire country of Iran knew that there was a pilot that was somewhere on their land that was fighting for his life. And it also made it much more difficult for the pilots and for the people going in to search for him. All of a sudden, they know that there's somebody out there. They see all these planes coming in. It became a much more difficult operation because a leaker leaked that we have one, we've rescued one, but there's another one out there that we're trying to get. So actually, the country, Iran, put out a major notice, you all saw it, offering a very big award for anybody that captures the pilot. So in addition to a hostile, very talented, very good, very evil military, we had millions of people trying to get an award. So when you add that to it, but we have to find that leaker because that's a sick person. Probably didn't realize the extent of how bad it was. I can't imagine that the person did, but we're going to find out. It's national security, and the person that did the story will go to jail if he doesn't say, and that doesn't last long. And I think everybody would understand that they put this mission at great risk. They put that man at great risk, and they put the hundreds of people that went in looking for him, because everyone now knows that we're going in. Over the past 37 days, America's armed forces have carried out more than 10,000 combat flights over Iran, unheard of, striking more than 13,000 targets. The F-15 we lost last week was the first manned aircraft downed by the enemy in this entire operation with thousands and thousands of flights. They got lucky. It was a lucky hit. You know, eventually you get lucky. But we got lucky, too, because we got both of them back. But it's a record that is unparalleled in the history of military air operations. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. It's such an honor to be involved with it. We were up late at night, and then we were waiting for those contingent planes to come in, and we said, come on, let's go get in, because they're waiting out on this farm without a runway, with wet, crummy soil, sand, mostly sand, wet sand, and it eats planes alive. And we're waiting, and we're saying, I hope that one can land and take off. And they came in like magic, boom, 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 one after another. It was like genius. I'm so impressed by that. Because we were a little concerned. We said, boy, if they don't get in and get up fast, we're sitting in them. And that's called Iran Prime, right, General? That's where the whole bed is. And here we are sitting there waiting for a plane. But they came in so fast and so hard, and these guys knew exactly what to do. Let's go. Come on. Get in. Let's go. Pwah. They came one right after another, not at the same time. They don't want to come at the same time. They had to come right after each other. They didn't have any room. There was barely any room to land. Tiny little patch of very wet earth and sand. So I'm so proud of the people that I have standing up here with me and many others that worked. I mean, so many. Steve Witkoff's over here. He's doing fantastically. Jared Kushner. But the people that are here, the job they did is amazing. And I think I'm going to introduce the head of the CIA, and he is a man who he's central casting, okay? If we cast a movie, he's going to play the head of the CIA. He's one of the few. John Ratcliffe, he did a phenomenal job that night. He did something that I don't know if you want to talk about it. If you want, you can. I'm not sure he's supposed to. I'm not going to talk about it. But he really, the CIA was very responsible for finding this little speck. It's like they used an expression on one of the shows. A general was talking about, it's like finding a needle in a haystack, finding this pilot. And the CIA was unbelievable. And you may, if you can, you'll talk. It might be classified, in which case I'd have to put him in jail if he talks about it. And I don't want to put him in jail. He doesn't deserve that. So, John, do you want to say a few words? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's a privilege to be here with you today to share what we can about this exceptional mission and to recognize the ingenuity and bravery of those who executed it, as well as the leadership and resolve of the president who ordered it. One thing that has been clear to me in this role is that the flawless military operations that the Department of War is known for are hostage to flawless intelligence. We saw that in the skies over Iran in Operation Midnight Hammer last summer. We witnessed it in Venezuela during Operation Absolute Resolve. We've seen it against the cartels in the Western Hemisphere, and we're seeing it every day in Operation Epic Fury, including this mission to rescue an aviator buried deep behind enemy lines. Because it is the unique tradition of the U.S. Armed Forces that we leave no man or woman behind, this was a no-fail mission. That was the spirit in which the president put us to work, and we were determined not to let him down or our airmen down. As an agency, the CIA possesses unique capabilities that only the president can deploy. Some of these capabilities fall under covert action authorities. And because covert means exactly that, I'm not going to be able to tell you everything that you want to know. At the president's direction, we deployed both human assets and exquisite technologies that no other intelligence service in the world possesses to a daunting challenge, comparable to hunting for a single grain of sand in the middle of a desert. This was also a race against the clock, as it was critical that we locate the downed aviator as quickly as possible, while at the same time keeping our enemies misdirected. For that reason, in addition to the human and technical assets deployed by the president to find our airmen, CIA executed a deception campaign to confuse the Iranians, who were desperately hunting for our airmen. On Saturday morning, we achieved our primary objective by finding and providing confirmation that one of America's best and bravest was alive and concealed in a mountain crevice, still invisible to the enemy, but not to the CIA. That confirmation was relayed by Secretary Hegseth to the president, and the operation quickly moved to the execution phase. Following the successful exfiltration on Saturday night, our intelligence reflects that the Iranians were embarrassed and ultimately humiliated by the success of this audacious rescue mission. When the president asked me to lead the CIA, he made it clear, get back to basics, no politics, no agendas. Tackle the hardest problems and execute the toughest missions. This president is about results. And now, that's what his CIA is about, too. The professionals at the agency and at the Department of War deserve immense credit for their flawless execution during this daring mission. Their skill, creativity, and courage are unmatched on the battlefield wherever they step. But none of that matters, and all of that is wasted without a president with the political courage to put them into action. Mr. President, I've had the privilege of seeing you act with political courage in the best interest of the United States up close on a daily basis, and I'm grateful that this successful mission has given the American people a window into that as well. The Secretary and Chairman will tell you that our service members' confidence is boosted by a Commander-in-Chief who has their back the same way they have yours. And I know that the confidence of CIA's officers is boosted by the knowledge that their work is informing a president who's not afraid to make the hardest decisions when the stakes are highest.
That is CIA Director John Ratcliffe following President Trump during a press conference at the White House following the successful recovery of a second U.S. airman in Iran. More on this coming up on JR Afternoon with Ryan Ermani. We continue with Focus on WJR right after this. Busy Monday news day as we continue on Focus on WJR following the President Trump press conference. Let's shift our focus now, though, back to the big event tonight in the sports world, and that is the NCAA championship game in Indianapolis featuring the University of Michigan against UConn. In 2027, the NCAA Final Four will be held once again in Detroit at Ford Field. Dave Beachnow is the CEO of the Detroit Local Organizing Committee. He's in Indianapolis for tonight's championship game, experiencing the Final Four, and he's leading the charge as Detroit goes on the clock for 2027. Dave Beachnow, welcome to WJR. And, wow, it really goes forward now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. And, thanks, Dave, first of all, for having me. It's been a great weekend. You know, we've got a large contingent down here in Indianapolis this weekend. I guess it's Monday now, but over the course of the weekend to really take in everything that is Final Four. You know, obviously the event exists because of the games themselves, but there are so many ancillary events around Final Four weekend now, which is much different than it was back in 2009. And so it will have been 18 years since we last hosted. So it's a great opportunity for many of us, you know, some of whom this is their first Final Four. So just to get eyes on different areas of responsibilities and what, you know, our folks can expect next year.
Well, and let's talk briefly about 2009, because that was the first time that the Final Four was hosted in a football stadium. It was Ford Field, 72,000 fans, a record at that time for the Final Four and NCAA championship game. And MSU was in that championship game, unfortunately losing to North Carolina. But yes, 18 years later, the city of Detroit is much different than it was in 2009. And the Final Four, as you describe, Dade Beach now, is also much different than it was in 2009.
Absolutely. And in 2009, certainly they moved the court to the 50-yard line. It had been traditionally in football stadiums, but they put the court in the end zone. 2009 was the first year in the round, so to speak. And when you just look at the March Madness Music Festival, which they had a semblance of that back in 2009, now, you know, it's drawing A-list talent. They had Post Malone last night performing with over 20,000 people attending that concert. You know, Zac Brown Band played on Saturday. And so it's more of an entertainment opportunity for our local residents and visitors alike. And the beauty of it is not everyone's going to have a ticket to the games, of course, but they'll have an opportunity to attend the music festival free and open to the public. There's a major fan fest that will take place at the convention center that is largely free and open to the public. And it's the interactive opportunities, the sponsor activations, and all of those things that you could expect. And so, you know, I'm extremely excited about the opportunity to bring the Final Four back to Detroit and what it's going to mean for our community and the opportunities for our community to be engaged with it.
Yes, that's really an important part because, as you mentioned, well, A, the tickets are expensive. They're not going to be available to, you know, everyone. People come from across the country, you know, for the Final Four. But we've got such great experience now in hosting major events. I mean, the NFL draft was an incredible success in 2024 in the city of Detroit. And that has led us to this huge event, again, putting the city of Detroit and this entire region in the spotlight once again across the country and worldwide, frankly.
Yeah, no question. And, you know, you point back to the NFL draft and how, you know, the community really came together, you know, all the stakeholders. There's so much more collaboration now than there was maybe, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And you know, there were some learnings, obviously, from the NFL draft, and certainly, you know, the opportunity to partner with various stakeholders in the community. And while the Final Four is a big event, it's much different than the NFL draft because of all of the ancillary events that will take place throughout the city, where the draft was really concentrated in one specific area. And so when you think about games at Ford Field, music festival locations still to be determined, but Fan Fest will be at the convention center. And then the community aspect of it, yesterday on Sunday, and each year they do this, they have a Final Four dribble for local youth, and kids can pre-register. They get a Final Four t-shirt and a basketball, and they'll start from one origination point and finish at the Fan Fest. And 3,000 kids dribbling down, you know, the streets of Indianapolis yesterday, and it'll be much the same next year in Detroit. Again, a free event and an opportunity for, you know, our local community to really participate. And then one final community aspect of it is a Read to the Final Four program, which is a third grade reading competition, which will launch here this fall, where students will calculate and their minutes read, and then the top four schools will be invited to Final Four weekend. And today they're having a celebration in the Fan Fest for those schools here in Indianapolis. So many different aspects of the Final Four, and in great ways for the entire community to engage.
Well, and great that you and your team are getting this firsthand look, you know, at the Final Four in Indianapolis, which undoubtedly will help you as you continue to prepare for the Final Four returning to Detroit 2027. If you want to put it on your calendar, April 3rd, April 5th, 2027 at Ford Field. There is an application window open for upper level seats right now, but so many opportunities to be engaged, much of it free, as Dave Beachnow has mentioned, when Detroit, the eyes of the college basketball world, the sports world, shine on Detroit one more time for the 2027 NCAA Final Four. Enjoy the game tonight, Michigan against UConn, Dave, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Take care.
Absolutely. Dave Beachnow, the CEO, the local organizing committee for the 2027 NCAA Men's Final Four in Detroit at Ford Field. Back with more on Focus after this. And thrilled to be back home at WJR on this Monday on Focus. Michigan has joined 24 other attorneys general and governors in suing the Trump administration. The action comes after a March 31st executive order that would create a federal list of eligible voters and require states to submit lists of voters slated to receive absentee ballots. Joining me to go through this latest battle over elections is attorney Todd Flood, managing partner of Flood Law and host of Behind the Bench here on WJR. Counselor, good afternoon.
David Liu, my friend, great to hear your voice and great to be with you.
Yeah.
Hope all is well.
Yeah, all is well. Thank you. And thank you for doing this. Attorney General Dana Nessel joined in this lawsuit, which argues the order of the president, the executive order, is unlawfully interferes with states' authorities to run elections and threatens access to mail-in voting in Michigan. Governor Whitmer says it's the latest step in the president's effort to federalize our elections. What say you as it relates to this lawsuit and this issue, and what should we look for going forward?
I think Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution and the Election Clause pretty much spells it out pretty directly, no matter what side of the aisle you sit on. It's basically saying that it is left to the states. The time, place, manner, and holding of elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. So I don't think the executive, to make a long story short, in this section, and it's by no chance that our founders put it in Section 1 as opposed to Article 2,
mm-hmm.
It will be found to be too broad, oversweeping, and take away the plenary power of the state. The state has this plenary power. You know, for example, the president of the United States has plenary power over who he can pardon. The state has the plenary power of over how they hold and do elections, as long as it doesn't violate the Constitution.
Right.
Here, that's not the case. So I think that this will play out in the Supreme Court ultimately. I don't think it'll be upheld.
Well, and there have been many lawsuits and challenges, and in most cases, despite the effort of the White House, the Trump administration, they've lost in most of those cases. You think there is the likelihood that this would be a Supreme Court ruling ultimately?
It depends on how far they want to appeal it, but
right.
I think so. I mean, at the end of the whole thing, what President Trump is trying or attempting to do by his statements is, hey, listen, let's get some integrity here. And this is a U.S. Post Office service, and we're going to put on that U.S. Postal Service, we're going to put a barcode on there, and we want to have integrity. So if you want to balance his argument, he's going for, trying to get rid of any kind of skullduggery, if you will, with regards to voting. But again, it really is a tough road to hoe. It's pushing a log up a hill for that argument, because we are clear with the Constitution that the states have the authority to do the way the act. I mean, if you look at it in 2018, if you remember back, we had proposal Prop 3 that passed that dealt with voting
and mail-in voting, and it was approved by voters in the state of Michigan for Michigan elections.
Exactly, and it was an overwhelming win for in the ballot at that time. And I don't know, it was almost 70%, 67%, something crazy. But at the end of all of that, we the voters, in our state, that's how we get things. Now here, the United States Congress, they haven't said, that we're taking away this, we're going to vote a new law into place and take it away from the state and have this list, if you will, given only by the federal government as it relates to state voting and who's eligible within that state to vote on federal elections. So, again, for the president's argument to say there's integrity issues, I don't think many people will dispute on the big part of that, but I think with those issues have always ferreted themselves out. We've gotten to good, clean elections, and ultimately, as much as you may stand for that integrity issue, the Constitution, I think, overrides the case.
Well, and legislature and elected officials, I mean, hold people accountable within the individual states, right? If there are things about elections and the conducting of elections that we don't like, we have that ability, right? As voters, as citizens in Michigan, to hold our elected officials accountable as well in terms of running sound, smooth, and accurate elections.
Absolutely. I mean, we just went through a major case which was dismissed, where people were brought and charged by the Attorney General's office for basically corrupt acts that went through its process. They won, but we have laws put in place, exactly as you said, to make sure there's the check and balance within our system, that we have, proper and voting systems that have the integrity that they're supposed to have.
Yeah. Todd, we'll leave it there today. Thank you very much. Todd Flood, managing partner of Flood Law, host of Behind the Bench with Todd Flood on WJR. See you soon, my friend.
I look forward to it. You'd be well, Dave, my friend.
Thank you. You too as well. It's been a pleasure sitting in this chair once again for Paul W. Smith on Focus on JR. JR Afternoon with Ryan Ermani follows the news here on JR.